You're a very good developer. Probably. Regardless, you write bugs, and that's unavoidable. What is avoidable is wasting time trying to track down the cause of those bugs. Sentry.io provides full-stack error tracking that lets you monitor and fix problems in real time. See the severity and scope of the error, get immediate access to the stack trace, connect the problem to the commit that caused it, and fix it without delay. Sentry, a name that's so common we have to include our top-level domain in our advertising to make sure you remember them. Sentry.io. That's Sentry, S-E-N-T-R-Y, .io. Open source, full stack. Web apps, native apps, mobile games, smart oven mitts, if you can program it, Sentry can make it far easier to fix any errors you encounter with it. Let's fix broken code together. Visit Sentry.io. This is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Camille Fournier. She is the head of platform engineering at Two Sigma and the author of a great new book called The Manager's Path, a guide for tech leaders navigating growth and change. It's actually a number one bestseller in engineering project management. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm happy to be talking to you. You just keep crushing it everywhere. I follow you on Twitter, and I've been enjoying your book. It's doing very well. It's been out for about a year or so.
Yeah, a little. Actually, coming up on 2 years in March, April timeframe.
Mm-hmm. And how has the response been? I've heard nothing but nice things, and I've been enjoying it in the four chapters that I made it through so far.
Yeah, the response has been really positive. I sort of wrote it hoping that a few people would like it, and I've been kind of overwhelmed by the positive response. So I'm very grateful that I was able to write something that so many people find useful.
Mm-hmm. Have you found in the writing of it that things like this are, they sell because of marketing or they sell because of word of mouth?
I think it mostly sells because of word of mouth, because there's not really any marketing. I mean, it's an O'Reilly publication. O'Reilly does a little bit, like they bring your books to conferences and things like that. But, you know, the only marketing that really happened was, for a while there, people were taking pictures of my book that they brought on vacation, which was kind of fun. And they would tweet them at me. And so I would retweet that. And that was like kind of a weird, like, viral marketing. It was like my book on like gorgeous beaches. Like someone took it to Fiji. And I'm just like, really? You want to read about engineering management in Fiji? Okay.
That's actually kind of awesome. It shows a commitment to the craft.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's mostly been a word of mouth book in terms of people picking it up.
That's very cool. Do you think that people who are managers are grown or born?
First of all, everyone has to learn. However natural you may be in terms of comfortable talking to people and, you know, leading them and, you know, natural charisma, whatever, there's so much work. There's a lot of detail to the work of actually being a good manager that has really nothing to do with your personality per se, that has to be learned. So in some sense, everyone is grown into a good manager. There are probably some personality types that will have a harder time becoming a great manager than others. I have worked with people who were managers, but were also like really, really good engineers. And sometimes what I see with those, especially when they're struggling to be managers, is a desire to just go really, really deep into the technology. You know, they're having problems with their team. Perhaps there's, you know, collaboration challenges going on, or projects are missing. And instead of taking a step back and looking at the situation broadly, what happens is that they say, you know what, I'm just going to like go super, super deep into the technology, and I'm going to, you know, shut the world out and look at it from that side of things. And if that is really your desire and instinct, and you can't kind of get over that, even after perhaps having it pointed out to you that this is not the ideal thing for a manager to be doing in this circumstance, it maybe is a sign that like you would just be happier and more successful focusing on the individual contributor work instead of trying to really, you know, keep at that kind of higher level and looking across a bunch of people, which is what the manager needs to do.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to explore the personality types, because like you said, you could say that a personality type is a natural leader, but it's really that they have characteristics underneath that, like maybe characteristics of empathy or seeing the big picture or whatever, that would then
be part of the formula. They're not necessarily a natural leader, but it's part of the formula that would make them an effective manager. But what is it about technologists that somehow make us want to, like, people don't compile, so we'll just, like you said, I'll just hide in the code because, well, at least I understand that part.
I mean, I think it's sort of natural, right? People always go to what they're good at when they're under stress, for the most part, is just my, my observation. It's true of myself. It's true of almost everyone. If you watch someone who is really stressed out, often their first instinct is to go where they feel comfortable. And so for a lot of engineers, especially those who are new to management, they feel comfortable in the code, or maybe they feel comfortable debugging things or, you know, helping out with operations or whatever. And that's totally, you know, it's totally a natural thing to do, but unfortunately it's not actually the job anymore, right? So your job has now changed to something new. And I think that some people can get over that and can force themselves to be uncomfortable. And in that uncomfortable learning phase of, like, I don't know what I'm doing as a manager, and I'm doing a bunch of stuff that I don't feel that good at, and just continuing to work on that and eventually getting good at it. And some people just continually refuse to do that and just continue to go back to the code or to their comfort zone. And, you know, as a result, don't really grow out of that.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where perhaps someone that you were, that was your direct, that you're the manager and you have people who work for you, and you have identified that one or more of the people who work for you are probably going to be better at being the manager than you are? Because I find myself sometimes in that situation where I'm like, you know, so-and-so who works for me really should have my job.
So I actually have someone working for me now, although he is going to go be a VP at a startup soon, and I'm very happy for him, who is best manager I've ever worked with. I was thrilled to be able to work with him, and I was his manager. And he definitely, you know, I think in a lot of ways was better at some things than I was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that was actually a joy, really, honestly. It's really fun working with someone who's just, like, really, really good at something that you also care a lot about and are really interested in. And I enjoyed that. So I have had that experience. And I'm very happy for him that he's going to do something new and exciting. And I'm very excited to be able to keep in touch with him and, you know, continue to, like, both share stuff that I know and resources that I can give to him, and also, you know, learn from him and learn from what he's experiencing. You know, I think especially at the level that I'm at now, you know, every manager and leader is a little bit different and has, you know, you can fit into a particular niche that other people wouldn't necessarily fit into that well, even though they're stronger than you at other areas. Right. You know, so I think he was a stronger manager than I am. And I think perhaps someday I would work for him. On the other hand, you know, there are things that I have done that he's never had the chance to do yet, right? Like, I've been a CTO and I am very comfortable with the management work of leading an organization and thinking about a lot of the HR processes, of sitting at a table with a lot of other executives and really presenting well, you know, with them, kind of, you know, how do you talk to those people? What is that executive presence like? You know, it's just not things that he had necessarily had a lot of opportunity to do yet. So I guess that's a that's a long-winded answer, right? You definitely have people who work for you who you think ultimately are better than you at some of the aspects of the job, and they just need to learn it. And I think as a manager, part of your job is actually to, like, give them those opportunities, look for those opportunities for them, and then, you know, keep in touch with them when they go off to do something great, because you never know who your next boss will be.
Yeah, I appreciate that very, very thoughtful answer. I know that is kind of a tough question because it is quite nuanced. You know, someone's not necessarily better than you or worse than you. I mean, we are the collection of our experiences, but I am always, you know, I've been in tech for a very long time, but I'm always so impressed when young people pick up things so quickly and so intuitively that I found to be hard won skills, particularly one in, like, trying to be a lead or a tech lead.
Yeah.
There's within chapter 3 of your book, you start talking about the idea of being a tech lead. And I've seen an interesting article go around the net recently that made the interesting observation that being a tech lead or being a principal software engineer isn't senior. Like the tech lead isn't necessarily the smartest person in the room.
Yes, I absolutely believe that. I've read that article and it's great. In technical companies, we often just wrap a lot of things up together that don't need to be wrapped up together. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot, we do this thing where we want our leaders or we want people in these positions to be the best at everything. Like, you know, they should be the smartest mm-hmm. person in the room, the most technical, the best talker, the best, you know, just everything. And those people most people just don't have all of those skills. And so then we often say, okay, well, if I have to pick one, I'm going to go for smartest / most technical, because that's, you know, that's who I know the team will respect the, you know, the core, that they know how to do the core work really, really well, because they're the most technical. But, mm-hmm. you know, when the job isn't actually about doing the most difficult technical work, putting the most technical person in the job may not be the right thing to do. I think the tech lead job, and I talk about this in my book, I think a lot of the tech lead job is there's a large amount of project management in it. There's a large amount of how am I helping a group of people get something done effectively? And as an engineer and working on engineering projects, a lot of that work is technical work. So you do need to be technically savvy and you need to understand the technologies that you're building with and, you know, and be able to think about the system. But that does not mean you're the best programmer. Mm-hmm. That does not, you know, that doesn't actually necessarily mean that you know like every single nitty-gritty detail of every single part of the system. It just means that you are capable of joining all those pieces together and importantly helping that team work together effectively. And I think, you know, mm-hmm. whether or not you're managing people at levels of leadership, almost everyone needs those skills to continue to become a leader. There are very, very few people in the world who can shut themselves away and change the world just by writing code by themselves. There are a couple of people like that. Mm. It's true. There are all, you know, there are, everyone looks around and they see these exceptions. Linus Torvalds, perhaps, right? But for most mm-hmm. of us, that just, you know, you have to be in the exact right place at the exact right time. You have to be such an, exact right place and exact right time is a big part of it. You maybe also need really exceptional skills. And there's just not that many opportunities like that. For most of us working at companies, what makes you really successful is that you're actually able to get a lot of people to do things, to create big things. And whether you do that by managing them, by leading them, by coaching them and teaching them. There's a lot of different ways. It doesn't have to be a management job. But the role of senior technical leadership is about other people. It's about leading, right? You can't lead if there's no people to lead. It's not about shutting yourself away and mm-hmm. writing a lot of code and writing the most code of anyone in the company. That's just very rarely the skill that's going to be, you know, the most impactful. So I do think that, that tech leadership, you know, it doesn't have to be the most technical person on the team taking the tech lead job. And in fact, a lot of technical people wouldn't necessarily like to have to do that because there's so much project management and not exactly purely technical responsibilities to making that job successful.
Mm-hmm. On your blog, you make the very important point that ultimately, if the engineering manager is not good at getting the team to be productive, then that is a problem. So, I mean, shut up and ship is kind of what I'm hearing there. You really have to ship, otherwise you're going to fail in those areas.
Yep. Unless, you know, maybe if you are a researcher, you have a little bit, you know, your time frame of shipping is different. Most of us are not researchers. Right. And even researchers have got to ship. I mean, you know, academics, they've got to get those papers published if they want to make tenure.
At Microsoft, where I work, they have this term, and I'm not sure yet if it's a Microsoft ism or if it's a everyone ism, but the term M1 and M2, have you ever heard that?
I have maybe heard some companies, these are like management levels.
Right. It's more like, are you a manager of some people or are you a manager of managers? And you actually have a whole chapter in your book about managing managers. When I saw that, I said, oh, those are M2s, managers that manage managers of managers. Like, you know, when you get an extra level nested deep, it sounds pretty exhausting and it's a whole new level of complexity.
Yes, it is. You know, to explain it to engineers, I often say, you have this level of abstraction, a new level mm-hmm. of abstraction that you may or may not be able to pierce, that is all about what's going on in this team. So, you know, when you're initially managing, especially if you're a technical person and you were maybe even a developer on the team that you started to manage, you have just this kind of native understanding of the software. You have this native understanding of the way things work. And that can make the job of management a lot easier because you just have good technical instincts and you can kind of know if people are working on the right things or not. Once you go up levels of abstraction and you are no longer really directly talking to the people that are working on the code or working on the systems that often, and maybe even furthermore, you never worked on those systems at all, and you're mm-hmm. just talking to the manager of that team, and you're really just getting what that person is reflecting back to you, that is a very challenging thing to figure out. It's very challenging to figure out, how do I continue to know if this team is doing well or not mm-hmm. in that scenario, right? How do I pierce that level of abstraction, or how much should I even do that?
Yeah. You, in the book, you have this quote, you actually quote yourself, which I think is great because it was an email that you sent to your leadership coach and you're saying to them, how do you help with problems that you weren't in the room to see? And I love this, with unreliable witnesses. Sometimes I feel like I'm constantly piecing together, you know, stories about like, well, what did they say? What's the technical problem? Or what's going on? And you said that you were spending all your time two levels deep in people problems, and it's exhausting. But you have to trust your people. Like, how do you find that balance?
You know, I would say, like, I'm still learning new ways to do that. It's hard. You do have to trust your people. And so everybody has like different approaches to doing this. Some people are really, really organized. So you do see those managers who, like, you know, they really love Jira, and they will like really, they will set very clear, like, you know, project milestones or whatever, and they will really follow along with the progress of the project. And I think I just can't do that, honestly. Like, both, like, I don't really like being managed that way, and I don't have the patience for that, even as like a manager of managers. So you know, but there are people who do it that way. I think, and that can work. There are projects for whom that can work, and if you have that kind of attention span and you can figure out a way to do that that won't make your team feel like they're just drowning in bureaucracy, great, right? And I do know people who successfully manage that way. For me, I do like a combination of things. My general philosophy at this point is that my goal is to make sure that I have as clear in my mind what is really important for my organization to be doing. What are the really important things for us to be accomplishing or stabilizing, getting done? And keeping those top of my mind and then top of my manager's mind and then getting those managers to keep those top of their manager's mind so that if nothing else, like, I'm just trying to push prioritization implicitly through the org by helping them know what I think is important. Because people do generally want to make their boss happy. They do generally, you know, want to be working on important things. And I think it's a full-time job understanding what's really important right now and what we need to do and pushing that through an org. And that's kind of the way for me that I these days lead. Now, that doesn't solve, you know, that doesn't really solve the people problems, right? There's also an element of you have to learn how to train managers to be a manager of managers. You have to learn how to teach people how to deal with people problems. You have to learn how to, you know, teach people how to do all the various basic management tasks and become more and more independent. And so as you're onboarding new managers, especially people who have never managed before, a lot of the job is teaching them how to do their job well.
This episode is sponsored by Stack Overflow for Teams, a private, secure home for your team's questions and answers. It's everything that you love about Stack Overflow now for your company. Get instant, reliable answers from your coworkers without disrupting them.
Unlike documentation or wikis, long email threads, or distracting instant messages, Q&A mimics the way that we naturally share and find information. Introduce Stack Overflow for Teams to your company and start building products faster and better. Visit s.tk/Hanselminutes to get your first month free. That's s.tk/Hanselminutes. You call out an interesting juxtaposition between the CTO having an open door policy. You always get that speech when you join a company and the CTO is in front of everyone saying, you know, my door is always open. And it's like, well, which of us is going to be bold enough to go and get beat up by the boss or our boss's boss? But then you also call out the importance of skip level meetings when someone's talking to their boss's boss in a formal setting.
Yes. Well, so I am a big believer in skip level meetings. I still do them. I always do them. My feeling about the open door policy is mostly that just people don't really take advantage of it. That it's a lot of managers, senior managers in particular, think that if they set this up, that people will come to them when things are going wrong, and therefore they're not responsible for actively monitoring the organization, as it were. They can have this passive monitoring because people will just bubble up problems to them. And therefore, if they're not hearing anything, everything's fine. And the truth of the matter is there are a few people who will do that, and hold those people dear to your heart, because those squeaky wheels can be kind of annoying sometimes, or, you know, kind of frustrating, but they are giving you information that's so hard to get. Otherwise, you know, you actually need to figure out what your active monitoring strategy is for your organization. And skip levels are a pretty good way to do that. So, you know, talking to the people in your team who do not report to you and on some kind of regular cadence, and just getting mm-hmm. thoughts from them about what's going well and what isn't, and letting them first of all, like a really important part of skip levels is really just making them feel comfortable with you. So if something goes really, really bad, hopefully sometimes they will be willing mm-hmm. to come to you with it instead of just quitting or, you know, what have you. So there is that, like, breaking the ice and kind of creating an actual relationship with members of your team that you may not otherwise interact with all that often. But then beyond that, you are trying to get some information about what's going on that I might, what's a different perspective on this team or this organization that I may not be getting from my manager. So it helps you, you know, independently verify the condition of the team based on your own experience with the team, instead of just entirely relying on the self-reports that your managers are giving you about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I particularly appreciated about this chapter, and I think is important for people to understand, is that people behave differently in different contexts. So you call out, of course, the benefit of skips and skip level meetings and one-on-ones. But then you say, well, if your organization gets really large, all you would be doing is getting one-on-ones. So then you should consider maybe having skip level lunches with whole teams. And what I appreciated about the book was that you actually call out, Lola, that people will behave differently in a group dynamic. If you are putting them in a group with people that they know or people that they work with or people of their shared level, there's lots of different configurations, and you have to recognize that everyone is going to behave somewhat differently and code switch, for lack of a better word, in those instances. And you as the manager or the CTO have to be conscious of that context that they may not even be conscious of.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the organization I'm in now, so my team is around 100 people. And so it's big enough that it's not so big that I can't have skip levels with everyone, but, you know, not very often. and then we try to do actual lunches for all senior leadership across all of engineering. And so we will do these like small, like the lunch or breakfast or whatever, coffee meetings with, let's say, 10 people in the organization and two of the senior leaders at my level. And, you know, it's an interesting experience, because I think the goal is for people to feel like they're getting FaceTime with senior leadership and they're getting perspectives on the organization. It is a little bit like pulling teeth, though, to get people in those rooms to actually ask questions and really engage. It actually takes a lot of moderation on the part of the senior leaders in the room to create a good conversation. It's definitely not just something that always naturally happens.
You yourself are highly technical, and I saw a video of you where you wrote your own distributed system in the early 2000s before things started becoming kind of commoditized. And I wonder what you think about devs who prefer to work with technical leaders versus this the kind of inherent suspicion that we have when we're given a leader who isn't kind of like, quote unquote, one of us, who didn't write code back in the day, someone who's more of a manager or career manager, and if that's problematic.
You know, I mean, a big part of the thesis of my book is that I do think effective engineering management is a technical discipline. Mm-hmm. That does not always mean that the best managers are people who spent a long time writing code. I do know exceptions to this fact. I have met people who were involved in technology in not direct hands-on ways who are still effective engineering managers. I think they're pretty rare. And I think it very much depends kind of on the scope of your job and what you're doing. You know, there's just so much of leadership and management in engineering is about kind of knowing really what's important to do and what you can let drop, because there's always just too much to do. And you have to be able to gut check what your engineers are bringing to you a little bit. Like, you know, you're never going to, the more senior you get, right, you're not like looking at their code and, you know, picking it apart. But if you have really like no instincts about the way that, if you have really like no instincts about the way that systems are built, it can be hard, I think, to ask the right questions and make sure that your team is really taking you in the right direction. So that's hard. That's part of it, right? I actually just think, you know, as an engineering leader, it's actually just hard to do your job if you really don't speak their language at all. I also think that there is a level of like engineers don't always respect non-technical leaders. And so, you know, people like to feel like their manager can do their job. In fact, this is like a studied thing, right? So I've cited this in a bunch of talks because when I read it, I was like, wow, there's an HBR article and some people did some research and they were like, they asked a bunch of people, what are the top things that you care about in your job? And they actually said having a manager who has some sort of excellence or authority in the work that I do scored higher even than like more money for a lot of people. Wow. So I do think that people care about feeling like their manager can appreciate what they're doing and understands the challenges of their job. They can talk to their manager. They can get ideas about how to do their job better from their manager. So now this doesn't mean that like every person, M2, M3, whatever, I don't know if you term it that way at Microsoft or not, but this doesn't mean that, you know, then you're a manager of managers and you're, you know, multiple levels up and you need to know and understand every single detail of every person's work, right? It doesn't mean that you should expect to be able to do the IC job at the, you know, at the leaf node when you've been managing for 15 years. But it does mean that you should have enough technical chops to be able to give decent technical feedback to your managers as they are then have a little bit more context and a little bit more, you know, technical depth at the time to give feedback to their teams. So I do think that for most people, having a good, strong technical underpinning will generally make their careers more successful as managers because it'll be easier to gain that respect and just easier to do the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel that my boss is good at BS detection.
Yeah.
You know, like he's not necessarily the most technical, but he's like, my technical sense of smell says that this thing you're describing may be a problem.
Yeah.
He's got that experience. In your chapter on managing people, you have an interesting quote from Mark Hedlund, where he says that when people become a new engineering manager, like when an engineer becomes promoted, they shouldn't think of it as a promotion. Like they do. We all say, oh, I've been promoted. Now I'm a manager. He says that new manager is an entry level job, because you really need to start with it in that attitude that I am now shifting. Maybe I moved diagonally, but I didn't necessarily move up.
Yeah, and you know, generally speaking, I agree with that. I do think people go a little too far when they say that you're It's completely, completely different job, because I think that people...
totally foreign land.
Yeah, because I think sometimes people hear that and then they think, oh, well, then why do we need technical people to be managers? And for all the reasons that I just said, I actually still think you are building on skills you've already built. Those skills that you already built come in useful. But I do agree that it is a very, very different job. And sometimes having a hard reset is the thing you need to do to get good at it. Because, you know, as I said earlier, right, it's very tempting, I think, for new managers to go back to individual contributor habits when they're stuck with problems, right? So they tend to use what's in their old toolbox to solve problems. Oh, this project is shipping late. I'm going to contribute code. You know, oh, this person is unhappy. I'm going to like pair program with them, whatever, right? And you do want to force yourself to say, I'm not going to try not to go back to my individual contributor toolbox. I'm going to try to, you know, learn new things and do things that are harder for me or uncomfortable, you know, dig into the details of the project from a higher level instead of just assuming that I can do a diving save by adding code myself. And so I do think that it's useful to reframe it as like a fresh start, because hopefully it will help you understand both that this is going to be hard. It's going to be a lot harder than it might look from the outside. And also that you should be trying to do new things instead of just doing things that you have done in the past that, you know, are easy for you.
Mm-hmm. You had a blog post a while back where you talk about the failure to delegate can be a problem if you're trying, you know, like basically when being helpful is actually hurting. Like something that feels intuitive may not necessarily be intuitive when you really just want your team to be happy and successful, but you also personally want to feel useful and needed.
Yes. Yes. I think, you know, sometimes managers will hold on to unpleasant work themselves, and they'll say, oh, I'm not going to make my team deal with this old crufty system. I will handle on-call for that system. Or, you know, they don't want to do this. They don't want to deal with like the release process, or they don't want to deal with, talking to this product manager who's giving them trouble. So I'm just going to take all of those unpleasant things and do them myself. And what can happen with that, when you take all of the unpleasant things and always do them yourself, is that your team doesn't have the opportunity to see where the problems are and create fixes for them. And you probably don't have the time to actually create sustainable fixes for problems like that, right? But where automation might actually just make that on-call problem go away, or that release problem go away, or where you may just need the engineers to see that this old crufty system is crufty, and perhaps we need to think about how we're going to replace it with something new, they're not going to see that because you're hiding it away from them. I also think that people, you know, there can be a great tendency from some engineering managers, particularly new ones, but not just new ones, to just really want to keep engineers happy. That they just have this idea that, you know, they're terrified of people leaving, and that their job is just to make their team happy all the time. And that's just you will not be successful if that is your attitude going in. You will, in the long run, I think you're going to have a really hard time being successful, because actually a lot of people, you know, they kind of don't respect that, and they don't realize that they don't respect it, but they end up more unhappy when they feel like they're never given any challenges, when they feel like they're never, you know, they never have to work for anything, that they're just sort of allowed to do whatever they want. And, you know, there's this idea that like most people would be happy if they just got to have full autonomy over everything they did all the time. In my experience, that's actually not true for everyone. There are a lot of people who thrive under, you know, help me get directions and help me focus and prioritize. And that's your job as a manager, to say no, to occasionally ask them to do unpleasant things, and to, you know, just to generally like help your team feel full responsibility for work and not just, you know, not just kind of like adrift and allowed to do whatever they want.
Well, that actually brings us to an appropriate callback. If we pop all the way off the top of the stack to the beginning of the conversation, where we talk about how, you know, as a manager or as a manager of managers, you're providing a layer of abstraction, but here you're cautioning us to not be too abstract, because if you hide too much, then you're really just, you know, you put a kind of a gross layer of abstraction on top of something gross, and technical debt will eventually catch up with you.
Yeah. And, you know, frankly, the same thing with organizational. A lot of people say, you know, oh, the manager should be a, put it nicely, poop umbrella. And, you know, they should be shielding their teams from, you know, bad things externally. And I think there's a little bit to this, right? Some organizations have a lot of politics and kind of unhealthy behaviors, especially at the senior levels. And, you know, if you let a lot of that leak through into your team, that can be very upsetting to them, right? They really don't need to know about, you know, executive X stabbing executive Y in the back. That's probably not healthy for them. On the other hand, I think a lot of people view that role and they say, oh, well, like, I don't need to let them know that, like, there's a lot of uncertainty in this particular product plan, and that, you know, we're struggling in this part of, you know, the business that happens to touch on my team's work. I actually think it's bad to hide that kind of thing from them, right? Because then they don't really have the context for what's going on, right? So there are bad things that happen that you do need to share with your team, so they have the context to understand, oh, we're struggling to make this product successful. They may have great ideas for that. If you pretend like the product is really successful and, you know, everything's going great when it clearly isn't, then they can't be part of the solution, right? So you want to be careful with what you hide from people, because part of what you want to do is get them to, you know, give you ideas, right? Bring out the best in them. And sometimes bringing out the best in people requires them to understand the truth of the situation, even when the situation is not great.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Yes, I'm very happy to have gotten a chance to do it.
Well, we've been chatting with Camille Fournier. She is the head of platform engineering at Two Sigma. And I would really encourage everyone to check out her book, The Manager's Path. If you enjoy this podcast, it is a big concentrated bunch of advice. It's effectively so much more in a great book, and I am very much enjoying reading it. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.